This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Dug Too Deep, the officially unofficial podcast for The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 5, Partings. It's the feedback episode. Aaron, how's that feedback looking?
Pretty healthy. I think as befits a rookie show, a freshman show with some uneven storytelling, we have got some uneven feedback in the feedback bag.
Okay.
The bag of feeding, as it was known among the Noldari, the bago fed ally. Mm-hmm. And we're going to open it up right now. If you want to pack it full, pack more of it. If you want, I don't know. I'm trying to Tolkify this. Fuck it. If you want to send us feedback, it's dugtoodeep@baldmove.com. First up is Nate in Nashville. Says, I have a question about Friday's episode. I believe this is the previous Friday because, you know, that's the way the feedback stuff works. We got some old business. Am I supposed to believe that a white tree losing its leaves is enough for an entire nation to stop hating elves? The episode prior, we heard about how much the men of the islands hate the elves who are taking their jorbs. Insert some MAGA statement here. And while the white tree losing their leaves and all of a sudden everyone is volunteering to go fight a war to support this elf, did I miss something?
Yeah, a whole episode. they kind of clear that up a little bit in this one, right? It's not the whole island that supports it. There's actually a pretty big rift there with about half the island. So, yeah, I'm cool with the way they told that story.
I'll take the devil's advocate then. Well, not really. I'm going to take the devil's advocate and then try to square the circle. I think you're supposed to understand, you got to understand that, like, these people live in an age of signs and portents. They take it very seriously. That's something that, like, I was really got beat in my head when I was working with Anthony, the maester I work with over on the hot D side. Mm-hmm. When I wrote that book on religions of Westeros with him, it's like a lot of times we as 21st century individuals will go back and we'll read historical accounts about their religious practices and stuff. And we think of it in the terms that we do in the modern day when we're living with science and religion standing side by side, where it's like there is a little bit of, like, to use a wrestling term, kayfabe, where, like, you know, we recognize that our gods are capable of miraculous things and can part Red Seas and can provide manna from heaven and can raise the dead. But we're also cool with that not happening in an age of cell phones because, you know, there's a certain level of remove of understanding these are kind of stories and whatnot. You go back 1,000 years, that distinction does not exist. Like, religion wasn't something that people went to church for one part of one day of a week and is clocked in and then they clocked out. It's like, oh, where are we going to go out for eat? You know, they woke up thinking about God. They did their work thinking about God. They went to sleep thinking about God. They worked their praising and their worship into the clothes they made, into the houses they lived in. Like, it, there was no distinction between their life and their faith and their religion. In societies like that, a sacred tree losing its leaves, being the tears of the Valar, that fucking means a lot. And then you go take it one step further and, like, they're living in a world where these gods actually, they're just in one continent over. And within, you know, living memory of some of these people came stroding onto their shores and, like, kicked ass and did things. So I feel like there's a little bit of a disconnect where it's like you have to kind of go all in on the fantasy. And then if you take that and you think about how easily manipulated, you know, I think in my lifetime, some of the wars in the Middle East, you know, how the public was kind of led along the nose pretty easily to where 90% of the public was on board with doing this, that, or the other. Whereas, you know, maybe 3 months prior to certain events, you would get, you know, no majority support for invasion of this country, that country. It's like you take those things together. The fact that these signs and portents are as real as like a news headline, a credible news headline is to you. And the fact that they also have these political elites that they think are just better than them because of virtue of their blood and their position that they've been put in by God, by the gods. And yeah, I don't think it's very unrealistic at all, because this isn't a 21st century society that's all debating about what to do on Twitter and spread, you know, it's not like that at all.
Yeah, makes sense.
John G says, as we now reach the middle of season one and we're getting the reports back and feedback and how different levels of familiarity to the lore in this world affect the viewing, how lost some people are versus others, let me inform you that on a lore level, the pace of reveal and the amount of show versus tell the showing is doing is specifically designed for me. Speaking of John G here, I don't think they're as amazing as some. I like them fine. The show, however, is making me more curious about the whole world than those movies or a lifetime of being a nerd with other nerds telling me about these books ever did. I watch the show. I'm curious. I listen to Bald Move and get some answers, but more questions. I go to the Lorehounds, get some more answers, but more questions. And I start to delve into the wikis and the fan sites and endless writing online to learn more, to the point that now, 4 episodes into the show, without ever having to read a single book, I'm starting to feel fairly knowledgeable about this entire world.
Wait, but you read the whole internet, man.
Yeah, right.
I mean, sure, you didn't turn a page in a book, but come on.
For someone like me, though, who loves the process of getting a little info from the show, but having the opportunity to keep digging and digging, and this world has so much to dig through that it seems every rock has an entire history you can look into, this level of show plus research is working perfectly to keep me fully engaged. I will say that, John, I'm a lot like you. I describe myself as a lore whore, and that thing that you're talking about where you feel like you overturn a rock in this world and there's history there, that is, oh God, that's what I love so much about Tolkien, because usually that kind of detail accumulates over a generation of multiple writers of multiple perspectives. Like, think about Marvel Comics, you know, how many, or DC Comics, how many people have contributed to the lore of Batman or Superman or Spider-Man or Wolverine, and how many times it's changed, or Star Trek, how many different creative teams. This largely sprung from one dude, all of the languages, all of the lore, all of the religion and mythos. And I think that's, and it's full of self-contradictions the way some of those other things are too. And that's, to me, what grabs, what hooks me into lore, is when I feel like I'm kind of a lore historian, where it's like, I'm having conflicting accounts. How do I know which one is true? You know, it's kind of like real history without all the baggage of like, oh my God, if you get a wrong understanding, you might start a Third Reich or something. You know, it's just funsies. It's all the discipline without any of the societal risks.
Yeah, that's what I'm coming to understand about Tolkien stuff. And I, you know, I used to think the Tolkien's universe was limited to like several books for Lord of the Rings, you know, it's not a trilogy, right? It's like a 6-book series. Is that a thing?
Yeah. Each book is 2 books. So it's a 6-book series.
Yeah. And then Silmarillion and The Hobbit. And I thought that was like all he wrote. Right. And that was everything. I'm coming to understand there are a lot more writings. I know some of it was released posthumously, but a lot of it, you know, he kind of intended to fill out the world. Short stories I didn't know existed, like all kinds of things. That he wrote. And yeah, he thought about this universe in detail. And it really shows.
I mean, it's I think it's beautiful. Like this guy took for like over the course of 30 years and just never stopped kind of working on this as his project. Mm-hmm. It's like a ship in a bottle, except for it's an entire universe.
Yeah.
I guess similar in a way to like Stephen King does his, you know, his Legendarium, like the continually expands and stuff. And he's never really stopped thinking about how he can connect everything together. Anyway, I appreciate that kind of depth of lore. And that's what really, you know, that's what really attracts me to things like Lord of the Rings, Warhammer, you know, Destiny, some of these franchises that have these conflicting narratives that you actually got to think about. And it's not as interesting as like stuff on Star Wars and Star Trek, where there's kind of like this official canon. And that's just the thing. It's like, well, you know, this is the right answer and the other answers are wrong. And that's not as interesting to me. Getting back to John Jesus, I think the show is aiming for this because it knows it can't fall into long info dumps about the world because it would be unwatchable. It can't rely solely on extreme Tolkien fans and Tolkien scholars, where you have to know everything extremely well to get anything out of what's happening. There aren't enough of them. It can't just cut everything out and only tell the most bare bones story for the most basic level understanding of this world either. It needs to engage at the level of people who know a little but get intrigued to know more. And maybe in the age we're in, some shows do need podcasts and wikis to go along with them, and maybe that's okay. Maybe that's a form of entertainment in our current day that we accept as valid as entertainment changes. The same way we couldn't do this show before the age of streaming and the age of Amazon's Dragon Lair levels of money, in a way that doesn't depend on ad revenue to create, that we can make episodes of various lengths, is maybe the same way we understand that some shows don't need to exist on their own and are forms of entertainment that require some level of engagement from the viewer just beyond watching it. What do you think of, and even John says that it remains to be seen whether there's enough viewers.
I don't know. I'm not sold on the idea that as presented, you can't get everything out of the show without going to alternate sources. I think shows like this are best done where the mass public like me, who has not, you know, engaged deeply with the Tolkien universe, can get enough to get by in the show and at times may like not understand a point they're trying to make. When I say not understanding a point they're trying to make, not like integral to the plot, just like a side point, right? Or like a reference they're making or something. I don't need to understand every single name I hear. But that information can be out there in other sources if I want it, to enrich people who do want to go out and seek it. But I'm of the opinion that, you know, some series have tried like video game TV crossovers, and that has spectacularly failed.
Sure.
Because not everybody can engage with all the material at the same rate either. You know, if you release an episode of a show or even a season of a show and you say, OK, well, this is meant to be consumed alongside this huge Wikipedia entry and this video game and a mobile app or something with an experience, you can't expect everyone to engage with that at the same time or at the same rate. So like I might not get to it by the next week, right? I might have something going on in my life. And then what do? Do I have to put off watching the next episode until I've consumed all of that extra content? I just think as you package it up and as you present it, it needs to have enough for a regular viewer to grasp, while also having maybe some inroads to external sources of information that people who really want to dig in can get.
Yeah. And to be clear that, like, obviously for Amazon spending, they don't intend this to be a niche show that appeals to just like lore archaeologists and historians. They need this to be a mainstream hit. And I think it's not that they're failing completely. I don't want to give that impression. I mean, sometimes, like, you know, we poke fun and are critical of the show. But like the more I see this, the more this seems exactly like Foundation, where it's like there are some sturdy bones and there is a lot of good story to be told here. But they just need to kind of decide whether they want to sweat the human elements of it or whether they want to go for the big budget. Like, all if they can do both, great. But like where I'm complaining about the show is where I think characters' motivations either don't make sense or are inscrutable from a human perspective. Because these elf lords can be like high and mighty or whatever, but like I need to understand their drama. Also, it's like to John G's point, like this show rewards more research and thought, but it can't ever require it. And also sometimes it gets in the way because like, oh, it's like Galadriel's like, you know, thousands of years old and she's had all this experience and she's been fighting this war for 500 years, but she still acts like a 19-year-old. That is something that just doesn't make sense from our human perspective. And honestly, I don't think it really even makes sense from a lore perspective. It's just them trying to have their cake and eat it too. And it might be, you know, like a side effect of them taking this material, which is a very much dry historical reference or even like biblical tales, and turning them into, you know, a drama. And the Hollywood has the same problem. Like anytime they adapt like a Noah's Ark type of situation, they have to get around the fact that, like, you know, Noah's going to take his family and get on a boat and fuck the rest of the world. You know, and sure. And God, you know, it's like that's hard for us as humans to understand. Like that is a crazy proposition from so you have to like start fleshing it, but then you start, you know, you're going against the Bible canon, and then that's pissing off the. So it's tricky, and I also question the wisdom of, you know, giving this big ambitious project to essentially two guys who don't have any credits to their name. They had an ambitious idea, and they were really excited about Tolkien lore, and you know, again, they're doing a lot of stuff that's great. Does Elrond? Gimli stuff, or not Gimli, Elrond, Durin stuff, amazing. Uh-huh. I like all the Harfoot stuff. There's a lot of depth there and interest. It's just they're really struggling with the great elves and the great men. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's because they're not relatable.
Yeah, it's interesting, or it's compelling intellectually, but it's not compelling emotionally a lot of the time. Like, right. That's a difference, right? Between like remembering, oh, these elves are 5,000 plus years old. Oh, they're not.
Sure.
You know, people who are considered very fallible, you know, mm-hmm. whereas I don't, you have to keep all that in your head and constantly like temper what you're seeing with that. Whereas mm-hmm. in most dramas, you can just invest emotionally as a human being into characters and feel the drama that they're experiencing.
Yeah, and like the elves have some of the same problems like Vulcans do in Star Trek, because, you know, Vulcans are essentially kind of like better, more elevated humans. But in Star Trek canon, like, there's also the idea that the Vulcans are a little bit self-important and mm-hmm. they're a little bit too literal, and they, you know, are not as adaptable. And like, if you listen to the Vulcans press, then you might think that they're the greatest thing since, you know, neck pinches were invented. But you know, you see other perspectives, you see that they're kind of limited and they struggle in these other situations, and it humanizes them because they have flaws. And I feel like elves are like the Vulcan press releases, but it's also just true. They're just better. Yeah, yeah. They're just better in every way, in every fucking way. And honestly, that's something that goes back to me in high school reading a Silmarillion, where I always felt for the men, these evil men that coveted the elves' immortality. Well, fucking course they did.
Right.
Because I covet immortality. I don't want to die. I haven't yet woke up to the day, you know, all memes and jokes aside. And that woke up to the day is like, you know what? I'm done living. I'm just ready to relinquish my life because I've had enough. And like, absent getting sick and old and infirm, I think most people would like, maybe you don't want to live forever because that does seem like a hell. But like, I don't think many people would choose 70 years and right. then like, I'm done, you know, let alone 35 or 20 or whatever short, sad lifespan some of us get. So like, that's just a basic problem. And short term, you don't need in the course of a 9-10 hour movie series, you don't have to grapple with that shit. But with these characters working together over the long term, you got to figure out a way to grapple with that. And if you don't do it right, I think that people are going to have their sympathies on the wrong side of things, as these elves are kind of insufferable mm-hmm. and they kind of got it all and they know it and they're not shy about telling other people. And it's tough. It's tough. These are supposed to be perfect people. Perfect people don't do that, right? Dan from Ontario, Kingston, Ontario, says, just a quick comment on the Meteor Man, the idea that he may be Gandalf. Not that Amazon isn't capable of completely changing the timeline, but checking my 1977 edition of the Silmarillion and the of the Rings of Power in the Third Age chapter, it seems to indicate that Mithrandir, Gandalf, and Curanir, which will be later named Saruman, didn't show up in Middle-earth until the Third Age. They also arrived as old men, and their appearance changed little over the years. Okay, I think we talked about this in some of the prologue material. I don't dispute any of this information. Certainly the Lorehounds don't either, but that's when they came in the Third Age. Is it possible that there some of these, you know, Maiar creatures had a pre-Third Age existence as different characters, but similar characters?
Like
that's
the
question.
And the Hobbits.
Yeah. Yeah, and even if this literally can't be Gandalf, and it might not be. I mean, he's, like I said, they're definitely painting them with you know, I feel like I'm watching an artist. You ever seen one of those stunts where the guy's like got both hands going and he's painting and it's like seems like completely disconnected thing. And then by the time it's in and it's connected, it's like this big thing. And it's like, oh, my God, look at this ambidextrous hero. Must be an elf. Mm-hmm. I feel like they're doing that where it's like they're painting with both brushes, the evil and the good brush. And at the end, it's going to make something. Yeah. But they whether it is Gandalf or not, they're wanting the casual viewer to make this connection of like, oh, this is Gandalf and these are the Harfoots and they're hobbits and Gandalf loves the hobbits. So, I mean, just saying it, I mean, I feel like that unless they're just wanting to live up their expectations, that they're going to have to subvert that. But they're also with the evil brush.
Yeah. It's also kind of equally be Sauron to me as someone who doesn't know the histories of all this.
Yeah. I feel like it keeps on like, I don't know. I feel like they've added one and a half evil bricks for every one or brush strokes for every one good brush stroke. Because they start with him coming.
Turn out good. Yeah.
But it does. Because like, I just keep coming back to he comes down in a giant flaming eye.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's being tracked by these weirdo Swedish death metal band that is certainly coded. You know, they're not lawful good. These people chasing this guy down. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, it's like I said, it's not that we're ignorant of the lore, but like they could do something different. There isn't, you know, we don't know. We know what Gandalf and Saruman are up to in the Third Age, but we don't know much about their, I guess, that pre-wizard existence of theirs that they had in the heavens. So I think both things are still on the table. Brittany says, I was listening to the episodes and I thought about people watching a show from their phones. I myself prefer a larger screen. That being said, there's no good internet service available where I live in South Carolina. My hotspot has a limited amount of data that I use for my business and streaming things instantly kills it. Yeah, I bet streaming 4K will really chew up the bandwidth. I consequently watch a lot of TV on my phone due to that. So for some people, it may be about not having the access to watch it on a larger screen. She says T-Rop is one of the things she saves her bandwidth for. yeah, I just feel like by percentage, most people who are watching stuff on their phones are not doing it because they can't. They're just doing it because that's how they watch. That's how they listen to media. Because it's convenient for them.
Sure. I mean, there are definitely edge cases where it's like, yeah, that makes absolute sense to watch it on your phone or whatever. I mean, you could stream it on your phone and then like AirPlay it to your TV or something. That might work out. I don't know.
And I get it. I'm a little precious with video because I'm like, that's the thing I'm precious about. But like,
and it's our jobs. Yeah.
But like, you know, like I like music, I'm a fucking goth. I'm a vandal when it comes to music.
Philistine.
I will listen to that thing from my tinny phone speaker propped up on a fucking poppet on a kitchen table while I'm making food. And I have Bluetooth speakers that would be better. And you know, there's guys also who and gals who are listening to like, you know, pristine lossless codecs on $400 microphones with oxygen free cables. And they're just cringing at the environment that I'm listening to, or I'm going down the road listening to shit in my car. It's got like 75 decibels of road noise. I get it. Like you kind of appreciate the art and the format and the medium and the way you can, but you know, I don't know. So, and I would resist someone coming in and saying like, you know, if you got a pair of nice, I'd be like, get the fuck out of here. I'm just cooking and listening to music, man. So
yeah, I'm not going to begrudge the way anybody listens to or watches their media.
Yeah,
but I know how I want to do it and it's definitely not on my phone.
Yeah. And it is just as like, there are, if I listen to a classic record, you know, music recording in my car, I'm not going to appreciate the way I would on a reference set of, you know, studio monitors.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm not going to appreciate the production and how much fidelity and dynamic range there is, because I'm not going to be able to hear it. Right. Amazon is made for like a 60 inch TV at 4K.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're watching on a 4.5 inch OLED screen, you know, 6 inches away from your eyes, it's not going to be the same experience. But if you know that and are cool with it, then I don't care either. But I think that 95% of people watching on their cell phones is not because they're like in sub-Saharan Africa or the swamp, you know, in the hinterlands of South Carolina. It's just they're sitting in their dorm rooms and they're doing it because, you know, they're trying to fill time for 30 minutes before the class starts, you know? There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep. Margaret says, is it just me as Galadriel always seem like she's clenching her teeth when she talks?
I don't know. What does that sound like?
Galadriel is Sindarin for she who clenches. Okay. Is for TMJ. What is it, TMJ? Is that the
lockjaw?
The teeth grinding?
Yeah.
I haven't noticed, but she is wound extremely tight. You know, if you're used to Kate Blanchett's like very airy, dreamy, you know, with a core of iron kind of performance, like this Galadriel is much more brittle and puts her iron on the outside, you know. She's a lot more, I don't know. I mean, she is essentially like, imagine like your most traumatized war veteran who's lost comrades and whatnot, and they've done that for maybe two tours of duty, and it's been several years. Well, she's been doing this for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, to the extent that like everyone in her unit is like, fuck this is crazy. We're tired of wasting her time on this revenge quest. So I think it kind of tracks. It's just, it's hard for us to imagine like what levels of fucked up and trauma you might experience, especially when you lived in such a state of bliss. This wasn't a person who was born into a hard scrabbled world. This is a person who was born into this warm cradle of divine love and light, where she, like she said in the beginning, like we never thought our joys would end. And yet they'd all turned to ash in her mouth. So they got like super fucked.
And now she's trying to convince a bunch of politicians that it's still important to fight this thing.
Right. Even though she can't even make this case to her own people.
Yeah.
So like I said, it all tracks, but it's like, it's that, how relatable is that? You know, like if you, you're like a war veteran you're white knuckling to society that appeals, but like, there's not that many of us in society that has that kind of levels that can, and certainly not to like, she's like to the nth degree of that. So it's hard to kind of like, damn, why don't you just kind of like put your sword and shield down and chill? because, but then the other thing is that she's also right. There's a universe where she's just chasing ghosts and wasting everyone's time and lives. And, you know, she just happens to be right in this case. So Dale G says, this is more of a general question, but do you feel like some of her issues, the Rings of Power, are partially a result of it being released at the same time as Hot D? I'm a longtime Tolkien book fan, and I've watched the Lord of the Rings trilogy more times than I can count, and I was thrilled for the series. While I enjoy watching a show, I don't necessarily get excited the way I do on Sundays for Hot D. At the end of the day, House of Dragons is just providing more exciting television with more action, sex, drama, and characters you really form opinions on and root for or against. I understand the source materials are fundamentally different, so the shows would never be carbon copies of one another. But my ability to compare the two shows week by week and the fact that Hot D is so much more engaging makes the Rings of Power seem worse in comparison. Do you think there's any truth to this?
I mean, I guess there could be. I like to think, as a semi-professional television and film critic, that I can divorce myself from whatever else is on television to enjoy or not enjoy and judge on its own merits the show I'm watching currently. But who knows? Maybe I'm biased because I am enjoying Hot D so much.
Yeah, I don't. I think if the Rings of Power, like, I think Hot D is operating about 90 to 95% of its potential. Like, it's really, you know, and it's not flawless because it is certainly leaving like all of the humor and warmth on the table.
Yeah, mostly.
That's a big flaw that, like I said, like I said, Hot D wishes that they had something like Durin and Elrond that they could lean on, and they don't. And I think Rings of Power is operating at about 75 to 80% of its potential, and that gap is what you're noticing. Because like I was thinking, like, we just watched Up, this Pixar movie, and it packs an emotional wallop. I was trying to think when I was typing this feedback, if I'd have seen Pixar's Up 2 days after I saw, I don't know, season two, The Leftovers finale. One of the most moving, awesome experience that led, and I took 10 weeks to get to, would I be like, man, I don't know, Up just doesn't seem as good by comparison because it's a cartoon? I don't think I would.
Yeah.
And as evidence of this, we actually saw on the exact same night the season finale of Severance, a show that we fucking loved. And we also saw that very night Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we weren't like, damn, I would have liked Everything Everywhere All at Once, but I just got to this very satisfying, complete journey of 10 episodes over. And that's, no, they actually complemented each other, I think, just a way a good beverage pairing to an excellent TV. Like, I felt like I had this experience with Everything Everywhere All at Once, and I came home and I had the perfect nightcap to that, which was the season finale of Severance. So I think that no, I think that the Rings of Power can execute. If it was executing at the 90, 95% level, these things would be a wave that just feeds into each other, because the Rings of Power gives you the soaring lightness and melodrama, and House of Dragon gives you the grays and the gritty and grungy and the morally complex and big. And you would have like this thing that kind of each kind of amplifies the appreciation for the other. But what we're detecting is the Rings of Power is just not executing at quite as high a level. I think that's my theory.
Totally. But people love to do, you know, the who won the week type of stuff.
Sure.
And directly compare the things. I try and stay away from even directly comparing stuff. Like,
right.
Sure, you can say it's missing this one element this other show has, but that show's always going to be missing something else. And I don't know. I feel like I want to judge something on its own merits. Like, how much did I enjoy what it was going for? How well did they execute that plan? How did it make me feel? Not like, what else did I see this week that was better or worse than that?
But I will say that, like, this whole discussion was a huge risk that we identified as soon as Amazon announced that they were going to go head to head with House of the Dragon.
Oh, sure.
But I don't, yeah. It's like, yeah, you are inviting comparisons. You can't like you can tell people it's not fair all you want. But shit, you know, if you really were afraid of that, then release it next spring when you had, you know, a clear runway. Right.
Yeah, totally. Although I would say I after like looking at what they've put up on the screen and thinking about the Lord of the Rings universe, I don't think there's much of a comparison between what Martin is doing and what Tolkien's doing, right? Like they're two different genres almost. One is soaring high fantasy, the other is deep political drama. And I feel like that's like comparing House of Cards to Star Wars. There's just there is no comparison. Or The Expanse to Star Wars. I mean, they're totally different shows, even though they might look like they're in the same genre, they're not.
But having said that, I think if you were in the middle of watching Expanse Empire Strikes Back dropped, you would still be like, God damn, that was an awesome experience.
Empire Strikes Back is a great movie.
I'll put it up again. You know, it's like they're different, but I think you can still compare the execution and it's interesting because like the Ryan Condal and the J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay have similar levels of show running experience. I think Condal's got, you know, he actually had one 3-season show that was fairly well regarded, like an 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, got praise from Martin and Stephen King versus these guys who, as far as I can tell, haven't done a fuck. They said they've been working together for 25 years. Show me their resume.
Right.
Like
IMDb doesn't have it. I can tell you that.
I think they're a 25-year writing partnership the same way Jim and I are a 25-year writer partnership, and that we've hung around since our school kid and we like debated about Star Wars and we took a stab at making a board game once or twice and we did a Christmas special, an unlicensed Christmas fan thing for... And I think you're seeing that like lots of enthusiasm. And honestly, the execution level is kind of amazing given their experience, but... they still are having some, I think, rookie mistakes in terms of connecting things and having the motivations down. And but again, I to me, this feels like a lot like Foundation season one, which I think was amazing and revolutionary and had some great big fence swinging for the fences ideas and had some problems. And you know, we talked to David S. Goyer about like, you know, COVID was part of that problem and just, you know, figuring out how to adapt this big sweeping story that no one had ever done before.
Also very I think similar this is also its tone, right? It's not this big emotional arc of characters. Yeah. It's more historical.
And I'll say this. I think the material is harder to adapt. Like House of the Dragon, when I was reading that, I'm like, this is an inherently cool story, but it just feels like it's had all the color bleached out of it. Like, it's just like this person did this person and this person said this, you know, like, and so what Connell had to do is take that and add, why did these people do this? If I can answer why they did this, because I know the how and what and when, but if I can provide the why and a satisfying emotional why these things are happening. So I feel like over on the Tolkien side, everything's just a lot more inscrutable. And they're fighting with one hand tied behind their back because they're trying to tell a story that they don't really have the rights to. So they're trying to backdoor into a lot of this. It's a harder job. But, you know, some people have been critical of how critical we've been. I don't think we've been that critical. Like, I think we've really liked and loved a lot of the stuff in the show. But there's some stuff that's just kind of leaving us cold. And I think they can get that fixed in season two.
I mean, I did compare it directly to The Walking Dead last week, but you know.
Yeah, it was pretty rough. I sucked my teeth on that one. I thought,
hey man, I call it like I see it.
All right, let's move on to Jamie H. It says, I'm hoping you can help me out with something. So the Numenoreans were originally taking 5 ships with 500 soldiers over to Middle Earth, so roughly 100 guys per ship. After 2 of the ships get blown up, I'm assuming only 300 guys are going now in the remaining 3 ships. I don't know why we're making that like... anyway, they're taking horses. I'm assuming food and provisions for the people in the horses. We just saw that inside the hold of one of the ships where Kimmon used the rum or jet fuel to blow it up. But looking at the ships as they appear on the surface, which certainly don't look like they each had 100 people on deck, none of them look big enough to hold anything down below, let alone horses and barrels of jet fuel. How do ships work? Am I not supposed to think about this too hard and focus instead on how incredibly beautiful the ships look as they unfurl their sails? What do you think about this?
I really don't know. What, you know a lot more about the Age of Sail type ships than I do.
You're goddamn right.
How big do they look on the outside as compared to their cargo holds?
Well, so there's stuff underwater, and that's usually where in the the holds are, and there could be multiple decks. Like, to me, the deck that we were on is probably where the crew would sleep, and these casks of oil, I don't know whether they're cooking oil or their lantern oil or maybe their combat stores or whatever. That would be like not down in this deep hold where you would store like the long-term provisions and, you know, really heavy, bulky stuff, ship stores, extra lumber, things to make repairs. The other thing is, in the Age of Sail, as you mentioned, the British Navy allowed 14 inches of horizontal space and about 6 feet of vertical space for each sailor. Have you ever seen, like, you know, the Atlantic slave? Yeah, so like, have you ever seen this? And I hope this isn't an indelicate comparison, but it's the thing that pops in my mind. Like, you ever seen those, like, the Atlantic slave trade images where you have like all these people just stacked like lumber, yeah, you know, like the outline of how many people you could fit on a ship? That's how the British Navy stored their sailors. The difference is these people could like, they only spent like 6 hours down there and then they got up on deck. They were well fed. They were well taken care of. They had hammocks. They weren't just laying on the bottom in chains. It's not the same, but like that just shows you how many people you can cram into these ships. And if you've ever seen like the movie Master and Commander, the first 5 minutes of that's a brilliant illustration at the ship at night. And you see all these sailors are just hanging in all these asses are just free swinging in these hammocks, and they're touching elbow to elbow, ass to ass, like head to foot. They're just crammed in there, so you can cram a lot of people into the hold of a ship. But I'm with you, because these are like almost like those Greek style, like they're like some kind of weird blend between like these like more Eastern junk type ships, not like junk and like the garbage ship, but that's the name, you know, these full batten sea, the sails and the shape of them, and like some kind of like Spanish or Dutch galleon, and also like a Greek trimary, those long skinny kind of like rowboats, like a Viking or boat. They're like this weird unholy mix of all these things. And also, yeah, I think you're not supposed to think too hard about it, you know. It's like,
I mean, if that's the case, you're probably not putting another 50 people from each boat onto from each of the blown up boats.
And
onto
the horses,
each of these boats,
you're
going
to have horses for each of these guys. Because like the other thing is like
14 inches ass to ass, like,
yeah,
you're not going to be able to fit any more people in there, right? All room is accounted for.
It also seems like they're counting all the sailors as soldiers, which is kind of historical. Yeah. Like when the British Navy would land, like they had dedicated the Royal Marines, you know, in their red coats, and they were they didn't really, at best they could clap a hand on something and pull it, but they weren't seamen. They were just there to essentially prevent the crew from mutinying. And when there was, you know, action, they would get up in the mast and sharpshoot the other ship. And when they would, you know, do some kind of amphibious assault, they would be the primary assault force. But the sailors were expected to join in, too, you know, their boarding axes and their pickaxes. And I felt like when they said 100 soldiers, they were counting all their sailors as if they were soldiers. You wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Like if the British Navy was saying we're going to land 100 soldiers, they're talking about like the Royal Army that they're going to carry and transport ships and then land. That's 100 soldiers, not counting the sailors. So it's the other thing is, in a real invasion force like this, you would have like military escort ships, and then you have just transports that would have the horses and the food and the supplies. Because why the fuck would you have a ship that's designed just for fighting also be a cargo ship? But again, this is a fantasy show. I don't really know that you're supposed to think about all this stuff.
Okay.
Because like the other thing is, like, again, Numenor is this very powerful sea race. If they wanted to send 5 ships, blowing 2 ships up would not stop them. They would be like, you know, imagine the U.S. Navy at one of their big naval things, and they're going to send this aircraft squadron out, aircraft carrier squadron out, and 2 destroyers get blown up. Would they be like, oh, fuck, we can't do the thing we want to do? Or would they bring in destroyers? No, I thought it didn't make sense, a lot of sense either. Anyway, Max from Winnipeg says, like many people watching the show, I'm a huge fan of Pete Jackson's The Lord of the Rings trilogy and a massive fan of the books. The films have been something that me and my family have collectively enjoyed and shared over the past couple of decades, and our love for the films have taken nearly all of us to New Zealand at one point in time or the other. You've done the pilgrimage. I'm jealous. I've really wanted to go to Middle Earth myself and lay eyes on it. I actually lived in Wellington from 2017 up to June of this year. I moved there because of Middle Earth, but stayed because New Zealand is amazing. God damn it, I'm getting so jealous. Mm-hmm. That's the plan that I wanted to do in my mid-20s, and here I am still in Ohio. Anyway, all that's to say is I have very much been looking forward to the series. The show, though, thus far has been a bit of a roller coaster in terms of my enjoyment, though. At the start of the week, I sat my mom down to watch the first episode. She was moved to tears and so happy to be back in Middle Earth. Watching with her gave me that feeling of having this amazing shared experience with my family again, and it had me genuinely looking forward to episode 5. But after his most recent episode, which is my least favorite thus far, I'm seriously considering buying a one-way ticket out of the Grey Havens. Don't get me wrong, there's things I like about the show. I care a lot about the world and what's happening. I find the lore drops delightful and a lot of cinematography to be breathtaking. I just don't care about the characters and their relationships with one another, with the exceptions being Durin, Elrond, and possibly Nori. The Tolkien notion that even the small of us can change the fate of the world is kind of lost on me when I can't truly connect to any of the characters. Especially when we're talking about with Galadriel, we're certainly not talking about the smallest of people either.
No.
Even the most powerful, perfect elf person can change the world. The emotional stakes were so abundant in Jackson films and The Lord of the Rings are completely missing for me in the show. My enjoyment thus far has been exclusively plot driven. Also, if I have to sit through one more scene asking a group of 40 extras to stand and fight, I'm going to stand and fight. This and someone saying a war is coming has become such cliched in every big name streaming show that I die so severely inside every time I hear them that I'm about to pass into the Shadow Realm. Keep up the great work and maybe see you all in Valinor. I think these are all real, genuine problems with people engaging with the material because it's not like The Lord of the Rings, which was essentially a ragtag group of people who were down on their luck and backs against the wall, you know, having a team together. Like, we're talking about the elves at the height of their power. We're talking about men nearing the height of their power. We're talking about hobbits not even kind of like fully evolved yet. Dwarves at the height of their power. And we haven't even gotten to the inciting event. You know, is it Meteor Man? Is it the creation of the rings? And we're 5 episodes in. So, like, I think it's understandable for people to be feeling this way. But if they do things right, I think this time will be rewarding. The problem is I don't think they're doing this part right, because I think you're supposed to start to fall in love with Isildur and his family and really be invested in their fates. I don't know if you listened to the last podcast recorded. Mm. Fuck Isildur.
Yeah.
He's the worst kind of dork, self-important dork. You know, his sister is just going to be canonically wrong, you know, and like she's, you know, like, you don't have to think too hard to think that she's just going to be wrong about everything. Elendil is a talking out both sides of his mouth politician. And Galadriel, we've already talked about Galadriel and Gil-galad and all them. It's rough.
I don't know. Elendil looks positively benevolent compared to Farazan. I'm looking at Farazan and I'm like, okay, this is the guy I'm not supposed to like. He's the politician. He's the lying snake. And then there's Elendil, who I think is a lot more genuine.
Yeah. And I'll push back because I you know, usually at this point in season, you know, especially people are new to Bald Move, they'll be, I'll start getting the smattering of like, well, if you hate the show this much, why are you even watching it? I don't hate the show. I like the show a lot, and I'm hoping it's going to be better in second season. And it's going to be so rewarding if it is better in second season to hear us like 100% praising the show, because you know that we saw the problems. We weren't just blind loving it, okay? And on the other hand, the people who have been like having problems with season one, if season two comes around and it gets worse or doesn't improve, they'll feel vindicated because like they've known. It's just the way, like, it's just the way the podcasting game goes, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think this show is good. I think next season will be even better. It definitely has some growing pains that can be resolved. And the beauty part of it is, we talked about this many times, the execution of season one is not important, because when you get to season two and they start executing at a higher level, you won't remember all the clunky things about season one. You'll just remember the moments that they want you to remember. The time that Halbrand and Galadriel clasp elbows, and the time that Isildur finally tied his rope knot right. And, you know, like you'll remember the high points that they want you to remember. And those are the things that will build on season two. And you won't remember how clunky everything was. Conversely, if it gets clunkier, it just will all fall apart on its own weight. And we all get to laugh about Jeff Bezos spending $1 billion on a beloved franchise and failing. There's no real downside here, right? Okay. Yeah. Unless you're a poor Tolkien fan caught in the middle. So
we got a lot of rings of power to ponder. We'll be right back after this short break.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep.
Let's see. Oh, Max concludes this. P.S. It sounds like some filming will be done in Auckland, New Zealand for season two after all. He didn't include a source on this, so I don't know. I always found it very skeptical that they were just getting wholesale thrown off of New Zealand. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, James Cameron can't own that entire island. Come on.
No, I think it's mostly probably costs. Like, do we have to go back multiple units, multiple characters, or can we go to like an iconic scene that we haven't seen before with a few of our characters and get that? Like, that is probably smart money saving. And I think it's just like, just from a PR perspective, I think most Tolkien fans have, you know, as we saw from previous email, or an almost spiritual connection to New Zealand and it being Middle Earth. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like this heresy that you would try to do. You would try to film a Lord of the Rings project in any place else. And I think the backlash of just abandoning New Zealand as Middle Earth for the rest of the project would be not worth the couple million dollars you might save. It seems to me.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. I wouldn't take the chance if I were Amazon. I would want to try and film it there as much as possible. I'm just thinking, so
like, at my present income level, if I'm Jeff Bezos and I'm budgeting a high school production of The Silmarillion, and the play director comes up and is like, okay, Aaron, you've got $500 in this project. If you can see your way to $750 next season, we can make this and if I'm Jeff Bezos and I'm like, you know what? Nah, fuck you. Make it for $500. Then I get what I get. Like, this guy's worth $250 billion.
That's after the divorce. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He made it all back during the pandemic. So it's like, yeah, you can buy a few first class tickets for people to go to New Zealand and capture some of those New Zealand photons on digital film. Right.
You can afford to check a few bags with cameras in them.
Yeah. Yeah. This I'm just saying. Entropy says, cards on the table. I haven't watched the Lord of the Rings movies, nor have I read the books. I'm coming in colder than Ice Station Zebra on this one. I'm only watching to see how $500 million looks on screen. Having said that, do you think that the elves are just boring? They take up a huge amount of time on the show, and it feels like everything just drags when they're on screen. Their race appears to have no selfish motives, no real sexual desires, not much humor. This adds up to a race of people who just kind of appear to exist. 1,000-year lifespans seem torture to me. Yeah, no, we've talked about this. Like, think about, was Legolas is everybody's favorite character coming out of Fellowship?
No, he was one of the coolest characters.
He's one of the coolest characters, but he probably wasn't anyone's favorite unless you were like, no. I don't know, a 10-year-old just liked bow and arrow a lot.
Sure.
I think that like in the Fellowship that you really Fellowship, you really cared about the hobbits and you cared about Gandalf. And then, you know, Gimli and Legolas were kind of like comic relief. And they developed relationships in a second movie and all that. Because like one of my points is I think elves are only interesting when they're in juxtaposition of dwarves and humans.
Okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, they are. They're just perfect people making perfect craft, and they're smithing things that are gorgeous, and their blacksmiths look like, you know, they stepped out of Abercrombie and Fitch ad. Their hammers look like, you know, you would use to serve. I don't know. They would not look out of place on the sitting on a table of a king's banquet. It's like just everything is just like so otherworldly that it's only funny when you've got like, you know, the hobbits rushing in on Elrond's council being like, hey, you got all you important stuff shirt guys are talking and you left us little people out of it. Rawr, rawr, rawr. It's only funny when like Gimli is poking fun at Legolas and Legolas. And you see that like Elrond's the only elf that feels like he's got any life to him because he's got Durin to bust his chops a little.
Yeah.
You know, Galadriel will be much more interesting with Halbrand challenging her than when she was just this like this frosty vengeance queen. So, I think the elves work better as poetry and stirring mythological figures in books than they do as things flesh and blood people care about on screen. And they need to be opposed by those real, more grounded flesh and blood people. Raphael says, another superb analysis by you in the series. Well, thank you. While the writing for me is still an underwhelming C-ish, I've still enjoyed the series and anxiously await the next episode. My underlying concern is the pacing of the show and the specific use of the mystery formula. The same approach that Lost followed, where viewers are hooked on the show mostly for reveals. What is the island? Who are the others? While Rings of Power is not there yet, more than halfway through the season, it feels like they're still setting the stage. We don't know who the stranger is, who is Adar, what's the deal with Halbrand, where is Sauron, etc., etc. The new mystery elements have been added, and with only 3 episodes left, how would you feel if none of these mysteries are revealed by the end of Season 1? While not expecting them to reveal all mysteries, I would not be satisfied if at the end of Season 1 we are still exactly where we are right now. I feel like the story could move forward a little faster without taking shortcuts. Am I being impatient?
I mean, you're asking a guy who watched 6 seasons of Lost and was hooked for about 5 of those. So I can tolerate a lot of questions and a long wait. Or although after the experience with Lost, less so. I will say that soured me a bit on these ever snowballing mysteries. But I mean, it feels like logically the break for the season is the time to answer at least some questions, but just kick open some more doors. I think we'll be good.
I think by the end of Season 1, we need to know who the stranger is.
Okay.
And I think by the end of Season 1, they have to have forged the Rings of Power.
Well, this right? is all dictated by the books, right? Like there's a story that they need to tell in X number of seasons because that is the story in the books. So there are logical breakpoints, I guess. I just don't know what those are. And I feel like a lot of people don't know what those are. So
agreed.
Do you try and hit those exactly? Or do you try and keep mysteries going to keep regular viewers engaged or what? Or is there enough material there to hit like 5 to 7 seasons worth of cliffhangers, I guess, at the end of seasons?
I've shared this anecdote a lot on several different podcasts, but like I'm a big fan of Dan Harmon. He's the guy that did Community. He's the guy that's currently doing Rick and Morty. And he mentioned something that is like he identified as a weakness of like Netflix style serialized storytelling. He's like, if a Netflix show did Wonder Woman, you would not. Princess Diana would not turn into Wonder Woman until at the very end of Season 1. everything would be dealing with her mundane life and how shit it is and how she's lost connection with Themyscira and she's a female lawyer and maybe she gets mugged and she punches a dude through the chest in episode 7 to give you a little taste, a little hint, or they hit you right in a pilot and then they'd submarine that. And I feel like maybe there's a little that going on because it is weird that this show is called The Rings of Power and those rings have not even been mentioned.
Sure.
Like, yeah. No one, like, who's going to make them? Under what circumstances are going to make them? Why are they being made? Like, they are laying the groundwork for, I think, you know, like, the elves are in decline and the dwarves have this new material that they're excited about. And men are just, like, wanting to, you know, not be left behind and be outshone by these people that are more accomplished. But, like, to me, it would be weird if you were in season 1 of the Rings of Power and you don't got Rings of Power. But I also thought it was, if you had a gun to my head and said, at what season would Slippin' Jimmy become Saul? I would have been like, surely at the end of season 1. If not, then surely at the end of season 2. And if not, then surely at the end of season 3 after his fucking brother gets killed. And I was wrong. So, like, yeah, there's, and that,
and there's
that ended
Breaking
up
Bad
being
that does it in the pilot, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm saying, like, there's not right or wrong ways, but, like, the more they do this, like, really, you know, again, we're talking about the rings of power. Where are these rings? What are their powers? What are they doing? And we're talking about the other, you know, this stranger. Is he Saruman? Is he Gandalf? Is it? I think that, like, if I'll start feeling a little bit more nervous if we're going into season 2 and we haven't cleaned up any of those things by the finale of season 1.
I think you're right.
But right now, no, because I think, and in fact, I think they could have taken a little bit more time with Isildur and his family and established, like, by this, I want to know the nature of the West and what is that conflict and, you know, specific, because they never even said that, like, the western shore of Numenor is where the elf lovers live. Why?
Yeah.
Why? Why are they treating that like a fucking secret?
I don't know. It does feel like they have a ticking clock, though, over in Middle Earth, right? Because, like, the Southlands, it feels very much like they want Galadriel and Halbrand to meet up with the people that we know in the Southlands.
Uh-huh.
And you can't really pump the brakes too much on that because the orcs
and
are
I think
digging
they're going
directly to them.
If I were to guess, like, next episode, they're going to, like just when all looks lost, you're going to have a Helm's Deep situation where these 500/300 warriors ride.
300 warriors and 400 horses, yeah.
Yeah, ride over and save the day against this teeming orc horde.
Yeah, but you got to line all that up, right? So some plots have to be accelerated a little bit artificially, and others have to be slowed down, and it's... Yeah, hitting that natural cadence with all of these plot lines is tough.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, like, what I think mysteries only work when the characters don't know it, too. But, like, I keep thinking, like, every time I hear this woman's voice going, Isildur, and I get my email, it's like, ooh, could it be this? Could it be that? Why the fuck don't we know? Does Isildur not know? Does Isildur, like, why isn't when he's having a conversation and his friends and his sister are, like, busting his balls about his crazy dreams of the West, like, you guys don't understand. Mom is, you might think I'm crazy, but when I'm out on the ocean and the sea's always right, I hear Mom calling me from this shore and it's just fucking with me. Why can't they articulate this? Why don't we know why Anarion has gone off and where, like, does the family not know? Why are they not talking about it in connection with Isildur's desire to be pulled west? It seems ridiculous. If I had a rebellious brother who dropped out of college to join some fucking military organization, and I was at the family dinner talking about my desire to, like, check out this, it'd be weird if my dad and sister weren't talking about my brother in specifics, about, like, well, you know what your older brother did, and he went over there and he made a real... Like, why aren't they having these conversations? That's what's
maddening
to me. I
feel like the first time that they brought this up, they wanted it to feel like this lived-in world where they had these conversations already, but it keeps coming back up, right? And you would think...
Yeah.
That we would get more hints of it.
But we also, they want us to care about Isildur and his motivations and doing the, like, hey, we've talked about this a million times,
right.
Isildur.
That's just shutting
I'm
it
not
down.
It just shuts that down, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, this is rookie storytellers that have the big picture stuff right. They don't have maybe the smaller stuff in every storyline. Luke from Ireland says, in this week's episode, there's a scene of the Numenorean soldiers marching through the city streets to ships out to war. It struck me as a clear evocation of Peter Jackson's Return of the King when Faramir leads the Gondorian cavalry out of Minas Tirith to retake Osgiliath from Sauron's vanguard. The difference is in the rings of power, the soldiers and citizens are green and excited for the upcoming war. The Gondorians, of course, knew fighting Sauron meant death. Do you think this scene is just an aesthetic homage to Jackson, or is it hinting at the Numenoreans meeting the same fate as Faramir's soldiers of Gondor?
There's nothing but darkness over there.
Yeah, I felt like I gave away the plot that, like, my expectation is, yeah, they're going to go to Os Tirith and save the day. Mm-hmm. But maybe not. Maybe a lot of them get their ass handed to them. And they're going to come back. The queen's going to be bloodied and kind of broken. And Farazone's going to use that as a political machination against her.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm not familiar.
Look
with the
story. What following the will of the Valar led to. You know, Oh, their tears fell from the tree, and you know, the gods lied and people died. I don't know, something like that. No, I think it's supposed to be both. And I think you are smart to point it out that, like, you know, the Gondorians who are already war weary and they knew this was a Tolkien gesture that wasn't going to do anything but get them killed, versus these Numenoreans who are like, yeah, we're fucking big ass Numenoreans and we haven't gone to war for a while, but now we're going to get in there and we're going to do some good. A little bit more naive view of war. Jay says, I love your podcast. It's helped me understand and appreciate the show. Thank you. I've been wondering, is the Southland storyline in the past where Numenor storyline is in the present? We've talked about this previous weeks, this idea that, you know, we're doing a two timelines, like in a very Westworld kind of way. They say, while Halbrand is in the planning room with the Queen Regent and Galadriel, they ask him where the enemy moved next, and he says, the tower at Os Tirith. They then cut to the orcs moving to the same tower. Did I misunderstand something in this narrative? Jim, do you have a... I want to just do a sanity check. What do you think about this before I opine?
Okay, I will agree. I'm legitimately confused by that line. I was not...
Oh, shit.
I didn't think about it much, but... Yeah, when I heard it, I was like, oh, there must be something I'm missing, too, with how he knows where the orcs ended up.
I think it's more of like when you have a local commander in the battlefield and you have like these like joint strike operation leaders and they go to this guy and they're like, OK, what's the lay of the land? What do you I was more of like, where do you think people will go? And he's like, well, there's this tower here. This is the logical defense point. All the people that live around there know it, and the smart thing to do would be to move to this tower.
Okay,
it's not. I know for a fact.
He just says it in a way like they're going here, or
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They went here.
Yeah, this is the place where people would go and seek refuge at the time. Just in a similar way that like someone around Rohan would know that the king would go to Helm's Deep in a time of crisis. It wouldn't be that he's got clairvoyant powers. It's just like, well, in times of war, the Rohan, this is the best place to go, you know? So they're probably going, I mean, maybe they'll go out in the fields and get slaughtered and ran down, but that'd be pretty stupid. So, and if they did, we're going to go onto a pile of smoking corpses. We're not going to be able to save shit. So I took it as that. But clearly, if you were confused and Jay is confused, maybe they could have done a better job of that. Originally, I thought this couldn't be possible since it seemed like all the characters saw the same meteor establishing them as in one singular moment. But what if it's actually two separate events with two separate meteors? Oh shit.
Boy.
What if we got a Sauron meteor and a Gandalf meteor?
Oh, my God. What if we have two Norris?
Yeah. Oh,
what if one is dealing with an ice Gandalf and one's dealing with a fire Sauron? I don't know.
Yeah. But it's also said, you know, because like John's favorite pet theory is that this is one of the two blue wizards. She's like, well, what if this is both of the blue wizards?
Oh, man.
So, again, I think that everyone seeing the meteor was trying to convince us that this is all happening at the same time in the same place. But. Yeah. I also can't completely discount the idea that they might be being tricked. I would think that would be not wise to add a level of timey-wimey, twisty bullshit on top of an already kind of complicated narrative. Because every time you do stuff like that, I feel like it puts the audience at one level of remove. And you got the extreme situation on Westworld, where there's really no reason to care about the individual characters. Like, it's so far much, so much a cerebral exercise that it's like all about the plot and all about the what's happening. But
absolutely, I feel like going forward, the scene with Elrond where he debates on whether to break his oath after he's already broken it by showing Celebrimbor the Mithril is going to be like a touchstone for me, where I just say a lot of this can be just chalked up to error, to bad writing or like oversights or something like that in the scripts.
It's unfortunate
they made that error so early, because now I will look back on, I will look at everything that they do through that lens and say, they could just have messed up there.
Yeah, and like I think there's ways to make that scene work. Like, if you say like Celebrimbor is an elf and he doesn't lie and break his oaths, and Elrond has sworn him in a similar way to Durin did, and this is like stronger than like you going to your best friend and be like, okay, I wasn't supposed to tell anybody this, but I'm telling you, you're my best friend. And Celebrimbor could be like, yeah, like, there's a ways you can make that literally be true, but I the more I've thought about it, the more I think you're right. Like, that was just an unforced error. He's already broken his vow.
He has, yeah.
Yeah. He could have been debating whether to break the vow.
Well, he could have just been debating whether to tell Durin that he had broken the vow, right? Like,
yeah.
But in his own terms, yeah. So it's going to be
because that's like he could be waiting to morals of like, if I tell Durin what I'm actually after, then I've already broken his trust, but he'll know it and he'll be more guarded, and it might be less likely to complete my mission of getting the Mithril at any cost. Mm-hmm. But if I trust him, then maybe he'll give it to me because he loves me and by extension my people. I think that's the real tension. They just kind of fumbled the bag in trying to tell it.
Yeah, which is exactly my point. Like, they might just not be perfect storytellers, which I'm always going to come back to.
Yeah, and who knows? Like, they could have, like, they get roughly eight episodes, 8 hours to tell the story. If they shot 12, who knows what kind of mess got made in editing, where they're just trying to cut and then hone it down to the story they want to tell. I don't know. Caitlin says, I want to ask about the scene between Elrond and Gil-galad after dinner, because emotionally I was all over the place, specifically with the hope dialogue that Aeron mentioned. Maybe because I like Elrond and his friendship with Durin so much, but hope is never mere Elrond, even when it's meager, felt manipulative to me. Maybe it's just knowing that Elrond is still talking about this fading light in Lord of the Rings, however many hundreds, thousands of years later. But I struggle getting an inspiring, hopeful message from someone who just admitted to lying and using you and doesn't seem concerned with any stakes outside of those that are elven. Then the very next, well, let's talk about that first.
It's definitely manipulating him.
The thing is like the Elrond, I think the Elrond in Lord of the Rings is very different. He's a father now. He is worried that his daughter's going to make mistakes and they're going to be separate instead of being able to enjoy companionship forever, which is what elves, I think, expect of their children, that she's going to deliberately choose this man and die in despair in Middle Earth, which I don't think any parent, like, I don't know. Like, that's the thing. It's like, to me, it's like, what if my son came up to me and said, Dad, I'm really thinking about doing this heroin thing because it's going to give me such intense bliss. And I'd be like, it'll give you intense bliss for like 3-4 months, and then it's going to be fucking Requiem for a goddamn dream. You're going to lose your arm. You're going to have to go ass to ass. He's like, no, you don't get it, Dad. Those 3 to 6 months of bliss are going to be worth it. I think you're supposed to understand that that's what Arwen is choosing from Elrond's perspective. She's choosing the heroine because, again, according to the appendixes of Lord of the Rings, everything that Elrond predicts comes true in the fullness of time. Aragorn does die, and she is bereft, and she fades away into a shade and a ghost, alone and friendless and everything. Like, it's going ass to ass at the end of Requiem for a Dream. So, like, I'm not even sure, like, and I never thought about this until I thought about this in the context of the show and, like, the fact that, like, rereading the appendixes, like, oh my God, like, what Elrond was saying, what happened to her is just literally him quote for quote for the appendix. That's, I don't know, is it, were those couple hundred years of bliss with Aragorn worth the literally thousands and of unending years that she could have had in paradise with her father and the rest of her family? I think she gets to make that decision, but like you can question the wisdom of it.
Yeah. I wouldn't take it.
No. And like I said, I don't. Yeah, I don't. Anyway, Caitlin then continues the very next line. When all others senses sleep, the eye of hope is first awake and last to shut. I also did not take anything inspirational out of this. Instead, I'm sitting up trying to understand why they're using the eye metaphor here. Because all this made me think, as an avid movie watcher, is the eye of Sauron and all the theories about who in the show is actually Sauron or being deceived by him. Why do you invoke that connection here? Is this a foothold for Sauron's influence? What do you think about that? Because I thought this was kind of weak. You know, they talk about the eyes of the Valar being on them too, but they're not evil. They're just sometimes an eye is just being watchful, being awake. It doesn't necessarily be, you know.
Yeah, evil. It depends on the purpose you're being watched for. I don't know. I guess I'm generally I feel what you're saying here. Like I don't. I think. The idea that this guy is trying to inspire Elrond and using the terms of hope and salvation and all this stuff, while at the same time having admitted that he's manipulating him, I think it does undermine it, right? Like,
yeah.
How can I take anything you say seriously here if you just admitted to manipulating me? Why is this not just another one of your manipulations? You don't have any principles. You can't invoke the name of hope and expect me to believe you. I get what you're saying. Then there's the tension of like, do you make the elves these perfect, flawless people who don't lie or manipulate or do anything other than speak truth all the time? Or do you make them interesting characters to watch on television?
Yeah.
And they're trying to do both. And I think each part of that is undermining the other part. So, I don't know. I'm with you.
There's a lot more Rings of Power to ponder. We'll be back right after this short break. And now, let's dig a little deeper on Dug Too Deep. Finally, she says, I don't know how the Rings of Power will be offered or what their specific powers are, but Cate Blanchett says in the Fellowship prologue that three rings went to the Elven Lords, so it makes sense that Gil-galad as the king might receive one, correct? I don't know, based on the distrust I have for Gil-galad, plus the use of eye imagery here, I'm expecting the Rings of Power and or Sauron to be connected to this Mithril somehow. You brainstorm ways the Mithril could be absorbed slash snorted, etc. Could it be distributed to the elves via Celebrimbor magic-powered forged rings? So, given that this show is called The Rings of Power, I'm going to trust that the show is going to very much explain these rings that are given to the nine lords of men, to the seven dwarf lords, to the three elf lords. And if you want to know a little bit more of a deep dive, I recommend listening to the Lorehound Second Age podcast, chapter 4 in particular, The Rings of Power, because they talk about from, you know, what each of these three, because I don't want to say anymore because, again, these could be very real spoilers for what's to come. Yeah. But if you want to know, this has already been discussed by the Lorehounds, and I think they did a really good job breaking down what we know of each of the classes of rings, and in particular what the rings of power that the elves had and what their purpose was and what they're getting at. But I, you know, again, for people that don't want to kind of know, we're going to leave that in the archives. But if you're listening to any feed, you know, if you're listening either on Bald Move Pulp or Dug Too Deep, scroll back in the archives, find that chapter 4, and all the answers are there. And this is going to serve for our gateway into the lore corner. We're going to invite John from the Lorehounds now to answer a couple of questions that kind of delve, dug too deep for me and Jim. So let's do that now. Welcome back to Dug Too Deep, John, and thanks for joining us once again on our lore corner.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
We'll get right to it. E-Hoops up first. It says, regarding the tower at Ost Hirith, you'll note at the 58-minute mark that there's three spiraled rings around the tower, which match the three spiraled rings on the Morgul hilt. It seems obvious this sword was some kind of key to unlocking the tower at its full potential. At the 5719 mark, you see the mask of Sauron with the completed Morgul blade below it. Either Sauron gets the sword that completes the tower, or completing the sword generates the finished tower. This is on the edge of the mountains in the middle of what will be Mordor. I think it's going to be Barad-dûr when it's done. I'd give good odds. He says that this is also going to be non-canon since the foundation of the tower was made with the One Ring. I didn't know any of this details. I was wondering to see if you could confirm his understanding of this, and what's your scale of 1 to 10? What's the plausibility? And, oh, the other thing I was going to ask is, like, do you think these three rings on the hilt have anything to do with the three rings of elvish power?
All right, I'll take that in pieces.
That's a lot.
As far as the foundation, I think that, yes, the One Ring was part of the making of Barad-dûr, although I don't think it was necessarily the foundation of it. It just was a piece of it.
Maybe we should back up and say Barad-dûr for people who are just, it might not be clear. You know, the two towers in the movie, the two towers? Well, one is Orthanc, and that's the place where Saruman kind of camped. And then the other, Barad-dûr, was the tower that always had the flaming eye at the top of it throughout the movie series. That's where Sauron kind of camped out in Mordor.
Yeah, and it was around in the Second Age. So this would be, even if it's not like the same exact way it gets made, I'm okay with that. That's a fine lore change. But really, I think that they need to make Barad-dûr soon, because Barad-dûr sort of began in the Second Age during around the same time as the Rings of Power are forged. And we can see that that's a necessary device going forward. So I hope that we see it get made soon. I could see the season sort of ending with maybe the founding of Barad-dûr and the establishment of Mordor as the base of evil.
It would be because
what was your other question there?
I want to springboard off of that, and I do like that. That, like, there's something about the elves unwitting accomplices to Sauron's works here. Although, is it striking as a bit goofy that the elves had camped in this, I guess, reclaimed Tower of the Enemy? I had a lot of questions about why this thing looked to be in apparent ruins. Like, because to my mind, the elves just left. And it just felt, but no, this is apparently an old ruins that they've been camping in, using as their base of operations. Does it seem goofy to you that, like, they didn't realize that this was connected to Sauron, when if you just pull down some plants, like, there is a big old, bas relief statue to Sauron and him completing his sword and his tower and all this stuff?
Well, a lot of previous tenants leave furniture, but, yeah, I think that is a little goofy that they either didn't notice or they said, oh, let's not look at it. Let's just ignore it. So, I don't know. That's a storytelling issue, not really a lore issue. So we'll see what they do with it.
Did you think that there's a connection between the three rings on the hilt, and the three rings of elvish power? I guess that was the other. And I guess that's what we're both saying, is that there might be some key component in the creation of these rings are going to bring about the creation of this tower, the foundation of this tower. Since the tower already exists, the ultimate, final evolution of this tower.
Well, the three elven rings were actually the three rings that Sauron did not have a part in. That's like they are explicitly free from his direct influence.
Gotcha.
So I don't think that would be connected, but maybe they're trying to tell us anyway.
They could throw us another lore curveball there. Mm-hmm. He continues to says, if Edar is trying to destroy the sun and the moon, that'd be a nice side nod to the 1980s Middle Earth role-playing game. One of the campaign plots were the southern elves plotting to destroy the Great Lights, which is non-canon, made up for the game, to restore the stars as the primary lights under which the elves awoke, which is canon, he says. In fact, the title of that campaign was The Court of Ardor. Ardor and Adar aren't too dissimilar sounding. Do you think that, first of all, who owns the rights to these semi-canonical RPGs from the early 80s?
Because who knows?
I wonder, the showrunners, how much Tolkien stuff did they read? Like, how far afield did they range? Do you think there's any connection to what they're trying to do in these obscure RPG campaigns, or no?
Well, first of all, I'd say when you look at the mid to late 20th century, there was a lot of funny business going around with U.S. copyright. And for a period of time, and I don't remember the exact years, it was actually unclear if you could just use Tolkien's work freely.
in the U.S. I did not know
And so there was a company publishing The Lord of the Rings without his consent and without his profit for a while. And it took a really long time and like a fan campaign of buy Tolkien's real books, buy the ones that he makes money from to get this going, to get this gone. So I don't know if that was in this period, but it could be in that shaky period of copyright.
Hmm.
And then, I mean, I think that this is just not accurate to lore of elves trying to destroy the sun and moon. I mean, they like the light of the trees better than they like the stars. Now, at the same time, there are these elves called the Avari who were
they refused the call, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They did prefer Middle-earth. They chose to stay in Middle-earth. But it should be noted that at the time that they chose to stay, it was still lit by the two trees. Like, the light of the two trees hit the whole world. So it's not like they were just addicted to starlight or something. So,
gotcha.
I don't know. I think that this is just a fun little campaign in the world.
Okay. Let's move on to Lucas from Sweden, who says he's loving our coverage of the show so far. Thank you, Lucas. Both you guys and the Lorehounds have presented some interesting theories about who Adar could be. I really like some of these theories, but have, after this episode, come up with one I haven't heard discussed anywhere. In the Fellowship of the Ring movie, Saruman says that the orcs were created when the Dark Lord tortured and mutilated elves. I know that in Tolkien's writing, there are conflicting ideas of how orcs were created, but going with this, what Saruman says in the movies, the orcs do come from the elves. My theory is hints that Adar is the original template for the orcs, that Morgoth and Sauron based the orcs on him. So explain why the orcs refer to him as father, since technically he's the father of the race. But also explain why he thinks he will be a god. If the orcs conquer Middle-earth, he would be worshipped throughout the entire land. In the latest episode, we saw how Adar got upset when Waldrig called him Sauron. This could be because Sauron and Morgoth did experiments on him to create the orcs, experiments that are painful, and we see that Adar has several scars. Maybe this rift between Sauron and Adar has some orcs stay with Sauron, while some now follow Adar. What do you think about Adar being the literal father of the orc race?
I think it's kind of cool, actually. I think that that would be an interesting origin story. I mean, we've talked about on our podcast how that's sort of a controversial origin story because Tolkien was weird about it towards the end of his life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll hear Tolkien scholar Marilyn Pukilu, who's been on our podcast a few times. She talks about how Tolkien even considered getting rid of the whole creation story with the trees and replacing it with the sun and moon right away. So he had a lot of doubts later in life. So maybe we don't have to, like, erase everything earlier. So I'd be okay with it if he was a proto-orc. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. I could see that. I could see our Fallen Elves theory, the hostage theory, or I know people are talking about Maglor from the First Age maybe being Adar. So there's a lot of possibilities right now. We don't really have clues
have you talked
as to
on
which one.
Your other podcast, a Mag, because I haven't heard your guys' podcast that just come out today that you did with Jim. I haven't heard his Maglor guy before. Have you talked about that?
Okay, so yeah, we did some Maglor on feedback, and Maglor is one of the two members of the Noldor, two sons of Feanor, that held a Silmaril towards the end of the First Age and got burned from it. And then threw his Silmaril into the sea and disappeared, and we never heard of him again. So that's sort of what leaves the door open to him being there now.
That's how that got lost in the sea. Somebody got it's too hot in the kitchen. Yep. All right, and I've definitely heard that theory that he's one of those the elves that got burned. All right, cool. Like I said, Jim and I were talking on our feedback portion today about how. Surely they can't stretch the mystery of like who the stranger is and who Adar is past this first season. Like we need to get some kind of reveal on that, or it's going to feel like Bilbo says, they're hanging on the bell too long. do you agree with that? Do you think they can keep that mystery going, or do they need to kind of get this dispensed with this season so we can get on with the real? Because a mystery is not a story. A mystery is a way to keep people enticed to get into the story, but like. I've definitely seen before where it can get in the way of the story.
I think we need to at least know what they are. I don't think we need to have their whole backstory.
Okay.
But I think we need to at least know is the stranger one of the Istari or is he Sauron? Mm-hmm. And then we need to know what is Adar? Is he actually an elf? Is he some sort of elf? Is he proto-orc? and sort of who is he working with by the end of the season. Now, I could have like cold opens next season showing him escaping Morgoth and being rejected by his
gotcha.
People or something like that. But I think we need to know at least part of their identity.
I like that idea, the cold open, kind of similar to seeing Gandalf's titanic battle with the Balrog after the fact, you know, open with something that gives you a little bit more information, but already tells you something, you know, that you might have already noted an inkling of. I like that. Where do people go if they want to hear more Lorehounds this season?
Yeah, you can check out the Lorehounds, the Rings of Power Lorecast. That's our fire hose feed. That's going to have everything we do forever till the end of time. You can send us feedback at secondage@baldmove.com if you want to get directly to us. We're on Twitter, we're on Discord, on the Bald Move Discord, and we hope to hear from you.
All right, thanks again, John.
Thanks, Aaron.
All right, thanks once again to John for helping us with the lore heavy lifting. If you want to get the Lorehound's perspective on how they're enjoying the series and the deep dives into the Easter eggs and kind of the lore-centric stuff, I highly recommend you check them out. Search for the Lorehounds on your favorite podcast app to follow along with them. You can follow along Bald Move on twitter.com/baldmove. You can chat with us and the Lorehounds on our Discord, discord.baldmove.com. Of course, if you're interested in helping support us and keeping the bits flowing and getting a lot more bonus content and ad-free feeds, you can check out support.baldmove.com for all the ways you can support us. Please send feedback for The Rings of Power to dug2deep@baldmove.com for consideration for next week's feedback podcast. But until the main podcast on Friday, I am your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
We'll see you then.